He never knows whether his readings are correct or wrong. If accidentally he arrives at a correct decision, he is in doubt about its truth and authenticity. And if he makes a mistake, as is usually the case, he hopes that his rulings are correct. He's not only ill-informed, but is also sinking day by day into further depths of ignorance, being incapable of appreciating truth and being blind to divine enlightenment. He places his faith in doubtful and dubious assumptions. As he has never studied thoroughly to acquire real attainment and correct information, he carelessly plays with the traditions of our Holy Prophet and the tenets of Islamic laws, treating them as irreverently as a gust of wind treats chaff and straw. If a question is put to him, he will not be able to give a correct answer. He does not deserve the rank and status assigned to him. He is so uneducated and ill-informed that he cannot even imagine that real knowledge lies hidden in the very truths which he has refused to accept. And beyond the flight of his imagination, there are ways for others to attain the heights of truth and wisdom. But he well realizes the untutored and unenlightened conditions of his mind. So whenever he cannot understand a problem, he tries to hide his ignorance. Bloodsheds on account of capital punishments carried on account of his wrong judgments are crying for retribution, and heirs deprived of their rights owing to his faulty decrees are lamenting over the justice done to them. I complain to Allah of these people who spend their lives in this kind of ignorance and sin and die sinning and leaving their bad examples behind for others to be misled. To them, the Holy Quran has no use if it is correctly interpreted, and is of immense value if, to suit their sinful purposes and intentions, it is wrongly explained. There is nothing more harmful to them than goodness and justice, and nothing more beneficial than vice and sin. Sermon 23. Remarks of Imam Ali on differences of opinions amongst the jurists on one and the same question of Islamic law. The condition of these jurists, who pretend to be well versed in the tenets of Islamic law, is such that if decision is obtained from one of them on any problem, and if the very same problem is submitted to another, this second jurist will pass a judgment quite contrary to the first one. And if all such different and contradictory decisions are placed before the person who is their chief, he will approve every one of them. How could these diversions and differences of opinions arise? They believe in the same Allah, follow the same Prophet, and have faith in the same Holy Book. Has the Lord ordered such wide differences and diversions, and they are obeying his commands? Oh, has he prohibited them to play with divine tenets, and they are disobeying him? Have his revelations to the Holy Prophet been incomplete, and he wanted their help to complete them? Are they his co-partners and have the right to say what they like, and he has approved this arrangement? Or has Allah revealed the divine law in full, but the Holy Prophet has not done his duty in imparting and communicating them to the world, and these people are filling up the gaps? Praised and glorified be Allah. His commands were revealed in full and were fully conveyed by the Holy Prophet. He has affirmed and declared this in several places in the Holy Quran. He says, "We have not omitted anything in the Quran." Surah Al-Inam. And again he says, "There is explanation of everything in the Quran." At another place, it is emphatically declared that one part of the Quran verifies another part, and there is no discord and divergence in it. And then it clearly states, "Had these revelations any other source than that of Allah, you would have found considerable discord and disunity in their various parts." Surah Al-Nisa. Remember that to a casual observer, the Holy Quran appears to be a book very easy to understand and interesting. But the essence of its passages are far-extending, profound, and difficult to understand. For deep thinkers, its fascination will never cease, and its wonders will never end. 7:24. While Imam Ali was delivering a sermon in Masjid of Kufa, he was intervened by Ash'as bin Qais, who disturbed the Imam's sermon, saying that such a speech was harmful to the Imam. Following is a rebuke on that remark. Ash'as was a great hypocrite. He was the chief figure in the Battle of Siffin to bring about a truce and to save Muawiyah from a defeat. He had also once betrayed his own clan and got hundreds of them killed just to please Khalid bin Walid and to get into his good books. "You, a wicked son of a depraved father, a hypocrite, son of an infidel, do you know which part of my speech is harmful and which is beneficial to me? May the curse of Allah and men be upon you. You were taken prisoner twice, once by non-Muslim Arabs and once by Muslims. And on both occasions, your ill-gotten wealth and your family connections did not prove of any service or help to you and could not protect you from getting behind the bars. One who directs and guides enemies sworn against his own kith and kin deserves to be abhorred and loathed. Neither his friends can consider themselves saved from his wickedness, nor his enemies." 7:25. Imam Ali explains how and from whom we can take lessons to mold and reform our lives. "If you had only a true conception of what would happen after death, you would have screamed with horror and trembled with fright, and would have readily obeyed his commandments. But what the dead has seen is hidden from your eyes. Nevertheless, in everybody's life, the time is not far off when this curtain will rise and death will knock at his door. I wish you had really a desire to see. I wish you to hear and a longing to learn. Islam has depicted vivid images, has given true accounts, and has tried to explain effectively and simply of what is going to be the end of life and what is to happen after death. It is a truth which I repeat that Islam has shown you a way out of these horrors, explaining to you what to do and what not to do. Apart from the teachings of Islam, have not the historical accounts of nations and lives of great men enough material in them for you to take warning from? Have they not explained to you that the outcome of life is death, and where death would lead to? Who could, besides the divine prophets, be a better messenger of Allah to man than the history of mankind itself?" 7:26. How to face your destiny on the day of judgment. Heaven and hell are both in front of you, and death, as a matter of course, is driving you towards your end. Reduce the burden of your sins and vices so that you may carry on the journey with ease and may feel happy to embrace your destiny. Those who have gone before are awaiting you. Sermon 27. There came a time in the lives of Talha and Zubair when they started craving for caliphate, or at least for the governorship of some of the rich provinces for themselves and their sons. They found Imam Ali as the only obstacle in their way. And as they were actually the people responsible for the murder of Caliph Uthman, they felt that by falsely declaring the Imam answerable for this deed, they would succeed in allaying the suspicion against them and in gathering followers around them, or at least in driving people away from the Imam. They started the propaganda that Imam Ali was responsible for this murder. In this sermon, he has reproached them and has told them that morally and factually they were accountable for the deed. He also warned them that he would frustrate their plans, accept their challenge, and deliver them
a crushing defeat. And this actually happened. Talha and Zubair were killed during the Battle of Jamal, Basra. As a matter of history, Talha was murdered by his companion, Marwan. In settlement of old accounts, there was dissension amongst the thieves, and Zubair was killed by a fanatic Muslim outside the battlefield. Zubair's son, Abdullah and Marwan, the two arch conspirators, were taken prisoners, and it proved a disastrous defeat to their armies. Imam Ali then pardoned and freed Abdullah and Marwan, but also showed the same kindness and mercy to every soldier that was taken prisoner, and sent Ummul Mu'mineen with a befitting respect and pageantry back to Medina. Beware, Satan has stirred up his hordes and has gathered his armies against truth and justice. His underlings want a free license to carry on oppression and tyranny. They desire an unchecked freedom to tell lies so loudly and so repeatedly that what they say may be taken as true. By Allah, in slandering and falsely accusing me, they have not left a lie unsaid and have resolved to forsake honesty, truth, and justice. They want to place upon me the responsibility of performing a duty which they themselves have neglected, of an obligation which they have renounced, and vengeance and requital of the blood which actually they have shed. If I was a party to this murder, they also cannot escape the responsibility of their involvement. And if they have done it without my counsel, as the truth is, then they are solely answerable for it, and nobody else should be held responsible for the deed, and they should be punished for it. Their arguments go against them and prove that their demands on me are irrational and illogical and are not able to stand the acid test of truth and reason. They are trying to revive the dead schism and heresy, hoping thus to gain support from false accusations. They do not realize that falsehood does not possess inherent ability to support any cause. Disappointment and frustration await those who, creating unreasonable and absurd claims, challenge me to fight. Allah, the Almighty, knows what they are after. I obediently and willingly accept His decree and shall defend the religion and faith. If they do not accept my advice and disobey my commands, then I shall have to fight with them. That will be the only course left upon to defeat falsehood and schism and to defend truth and justice. Is it not a matter of profound surprise that they challenge me for an all-out war and a straight fight? Sad will be their plight if they forget my past performances and underestimate me. Was I ever afraid of a battle? Did I ever wince before an adversary? Did anybody ever dare frighten me? I shall crash their world around their ears. I have full faith in my religion and trust in Allah. Sermon 28. In this sermon, Imam Ali has advised the poor not to envy the rich, and has advised the rich to support and help the poor. Whatever a man receives in the form of children or wealth and affluence is decreed. These blessings fall like raindrops, bringing plenty of happiness in their wake. And just like raindrops, their quantum is predestined, lavish and abundant in many cases, and scanty and sparing in many others. Thus, if you find some of your brothers having many children and plenty of wealth, then do not envy and do not try to hurt or harm them. One must work and endeavor to better one's lot. And unless a Muslim adopts such mean ways of life as their publicity and disclosure may bring disgrace and shame to him, he may expect reasonable returns for his efforts. Happy is the lot of a pious man who is honest in his dealings. He awaits with pleasing expectancy either of the two returns. He is happy and pleased to meet with death whenever it comes. That is, he is always ready to go whenever called. And if he is endowed with a long life, he is contented and happy with whatever the merciful Allah has blessed him with. Of course, children and worldly possessions are pastures and flourishing fields of this world. But good deeds will lead to the gardens of paradise. And to many, Allah, through His kindness and mercy, has granted both. Verily, you must fear Allah and honestly resort to good deeds. There should not be cant and hypocrisy in your actions, because Allah will not reward the hypocrite. If one has been good just for the sake of show, then one must expect the reward from the world only. But if one desires to attain exalted places of martyrs and companionship of prophets and saints in paradise, then these can only be attained through goodness and honesty. Remember, however rich a man may be, he cannot do without helpers, and good opinions of his people, he cannot dispense with their sympathies. They are his best friends in misfortunes and calamities, and good protection against defamation and slander. The good reputation that a generous man leaves behind is always 1,000 times better than the riches and wealth which he leaves to be inherited by others. Beware that if anybody finds poverty, destitution, and starvation among his people and refuses to extend help to them, he will not increase his wealth by such means, while expenditure on charity will neither decrease his wealth nor reduce him to poverty. He who refrains from helping his people must remember that he has withheld one hand of help, and at the time of his need, thousands of hands will abstain from helping him. He whose behavior with his people is good earns a lasting love and devotion. Sermon 29. Upon my life, I never showed undue leniency towards enemies of Allah or towards those who bring harm to religion with their words and deeds. O Muslims, fear Allah, follow the lighted path which He has fixed for you, and obey His commands. And if you are not rewarded in this life, I guarantee for your reward in the hereafter. Sermon 30. When the news started reaching Imam Ali that Muawiyah's hordes were ransacking border towns and had even taken possession of some of them, when two of the Imam's governors, Ubaidullah bin Abbas and Sa'id bin Nimran, fled to Kufa, leaving their provinces unguarded and undefended, and when the Imam learned that Ubaidullah bin Abbas's flight was so precipitated that he even had left behind his wife and two small babies, who were very brutally murdered by Basr bin Abi Artat, the commander of Muawiyah's armies, he felt very sad and annoyed at their cowardice and at their failure to observe discipline and obey orders. He delivered the following sermon. Very little besides Kufa is left to me to control and to trust upon. And O people of Kufa, if you too betray me, and if storms of opposition rise against me within your gates also, then I am justified in feeling sad, disappointed, and grieved. News has reached me that Basr bin Abi Artat has reached Yemen. I am afraid his armies will capture that province also. You are bound to be defeated because you would not make the sacrifices necessary for the occasion and the cause, and because they put up collective action and help each other, though they are on the wrong, and you cannot control conflicting and selfish interests for overall welfare, though you are on the side of truth and justice. Even after knowing me so well, you have not acknowledged my authority and do not obey my orders, while they are united in obedience of their leader Muawiyah, though he is leading them to vice and sin and to infamy and hell. They are honest to their leader, and you try to deceive me on every occasion. They are managing their affairs very well, and you are not competent to carry on good administration. O Lord, I am sick of these people, and they hate the honorable, sincere, and religious way of life that I want them to follow. They hate me on that account, and I loathe and detest their vicious and sinful motives. Either soften their hearts towards truth and religion, or give me better people and give them a bad ruler. Instead of these people, I wish I had with me only 1,000 horsemen from the clan of Bani Firas bin Ghanim, who were so quick in answering a call and so diligent in attending to duty. Sermon 31. In this sermon, light has been thrown on three phases of the history of Islam. Firstly, on the condition of Arabs before Islam and what Islam wanted to achieve for them. Secondly, the reason why Imam Ali did not take serious steps to defend his cause till the Battle of Basra, Jamal, took place. Thirdly, how Muawiyah purchased the allegiance and help of Amr bin As. Apparently, this sermon was delivered before the Battle of Siffin. Perhaps Sayyid Razi could not secure the complete sermon. He could secure only three disjointed paragraphs of a long sermon wherein Imam Ali had advised his followers to get ready to defend themselves, giving them a brief survey of the change Islam wanted to bring about in their ways of life, ideology and vision, and of the untiring efforts of unholy forces exerting themselves, in the beginning openly and later on, covertly, but always unceasingly. You Arabs, do you ever realize in what state you were when Allah, the Merciful, appointed Muhammad, may the peace of Allah be upon him and his descendants, as his prophet, and selected him as a trustworthy and faithful messenger of divine revelations? You were following a wicked ideology and were leading an evil life. You lived in dirty huts and unclean houses amidst hard stones and deadly serpents. You ate loathsome and unhealthy food and drank muddy and filthy water. You hysterically hated one another, fighting with and killing even your blood relations and friends. You had set up idols for worship. Your lives and your environments, your religion and your deeds were totally wrapped up and engulfed in vice and sin. I surveyed the situation which I found myself in and came to the conclusion that no one but my relatives, so few in numbers, will come to my help against the evil forces which have violently and vehemently gathered to subvert and overthrow the basic principles which had so long baffled and enraged them. I silently suffered the bitter disappointment because I did not like my helpers to be savagely and ruthlessly murdered. Amr bin As did not yield to avengers of Muawiyah unless he was paid an incredibly high price for the sinful alliance. The aid to sin so dearly bargained cannot bring success to the purchaser, and the allegiance so viciously procured cannot but end into infamy and sin. My friends, you are now quite capable and strong enough to defend yourselves and your religion. Get ready and be equipped. Do it rapidly, but not hysterically. The fire of war has kindled up. It has started burning furiously. Its flames can be seen even from here. Bear the suffering with patience, because nothing but patience will bring success to you. Sermon 32. This sermon is in praise of jihad, holy war in defense of Islam. It shows what it means and what it can achieve for you. The Imam has also pointed out the merits of bravery and has condemned cowardice. He has also denounced those who fail to follow his orders. The famous French historian, research scholar, and Orientalist, Gabriel Inkiri, in his equally famous book, Les Chevaliers d'Islam, says, in the extremely superfine, grand, and noble character of Ali, there were two traits which it is difficult to believe can be united in one man. History cannot show any other man except Ali, who has displayed these two qualities at one and the same time, and each one in such a marked way that no one can surpass him and very few could reach him. He was the greatest marshal of his time, even of all times, and he was the wisest man who could explain and expound religion, philosophy, science, sociology, and ethics in a style which was not and which cannot be improved. What is more, he was such a great orator that his speeches enchant you even 13 centuries after his death. In this sermon, as in so many others, the Imam has reflected these traits of his character. I wish I had enough control over English language, as a matter of fact, over any language, to bring out the force which his words convey, the pathos which they hold, and the disappointment at the behavior of people which they exhibit, people who had promised to defend Islam betrayed it at the 11th hour. At the age of 60 in the battlefield of Basra, Jamal, Siffin and Nahrawan, the Imam was as great a marshal and soldier as he was at Badr, Uhud, Khandaq, Khaybar and Hunain, when he was in the prime of his youth. And at the same time, he was as great a preacher and orator as the world has not seen before and will never see again. His all-knowing mind was very intimately familiar and well-versed in physics and metaphysics, in philosophy and religion, in psychology and economics, and in rhetorics and ethics. And he tried to convey as much of his knowledge to his listeners as they could understand and grasp. Of course, jihad, a war in defense of religion and humanity, is one of the gateways to paradise which Allah has kept open for his privileged friends. It, in fact, is an armor designed by him for defense of his cause, a strong shield to protect his friends from his foes and enemies of mankind. Whosoever turns away from it with aversion will be punished with disgrace, will be visited with sorrows and calamities, and will receive humiliations in life. The faculties of attainment, foresight and sagacity of such a person will be dulled. As he has declined the honor of defending his faith, his course from the path of truth is diverted. The world will despise him and treat him with humility and disdain, and he shall be denied sympathy. Have I not constantly been asking you to rise individually and collectively to defend your religion against these enemies of Allah? Have I not often reminded you that sometimes offense is the best form of defense? I swear by Allah that people who have waited for the war to come to their doors have waited for their destruction and disgrace. But you have tried to pass the responsibilities from one to other and refused coming to each other's help till plunder and pillage descended upon you and your country was overtaken from you. The armies of Sufyan bin Auf invaded your province. They killed Hassan bin Hassan al-Bakari and drove away your army from its cantonment. It is reported to me that these plunderers pillaged the houses of the Muslims and non-Muslims, snatching away jewelry of women from their bodies. What could these poor women do except crying for help and mercy? Nobody came to their rescue. These invaders returned unharmed, loaded with booty, sacked from the houses of Muslims and non-Muslims. If a Muslim died with sorrow on hearing these degrading news, I shall not blame him, but shall consider him a worthy person.